folks. It is good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us. I hope you had a good weekend. This is Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, and you are listening to Red Ice Radio, dedicated to the pursuit of truth, accuracy, real history, and a world where the men and women of this world live by the nine noble virtues of our proud ancestors. Courage, truth, honor, fidelity, discipline, hospitality, self-reliance, industriousness, and perseverance. All of us need to get smart and learn to stand up for ourselves and also the agendas that we are subjected to and stop them in their tracks. Our website is redicecreations.com. Check it out for much more. Today we have historian and former professor with us, E. Michael Jones. He was fired from the university he used to teach at because of his opinions. He is the editor of Culture Wars magazine and author of many books, including Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation, and Political Control. Also, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History. We are going to talk today about the history of the Catholic Church and the conflicts between Catholics, Protestants, and Jews. This program is not for the faint of heart, as Mr. Jones is a very candid gentleman. Some things I don't agree with, but others I do agree with. That's all fine. We need to converse and talk about these issues if we are even to get a chance to understand what really is going on in this world. So I hope you appreciate the perspective that he has to share with you today. And welcome, E. Michael Jones. Thank you for being here. It's great to have you with us today.
Good to be here.
Thank you. I saw your excellent, I saw you in the unfinished documentary Minority Rule by the late Byron Joost, an expose of the politically correct agenda and how it's been designed as a deconstructive and, corrosive, really, force on culture and society. And it was great seeing you in there. And there were some really interesting remarks, made and things I haven't heard about and thought about before. And you also come from a Catholic perspective, which is one that we have not given much time to. So it's well overdue that we shine a light on the other side of this as well. And I found it very interesting, Michael, in recent years to see not only the transformation of the papacy and the Vatican itself, but also how the Roman Catholic Church have been smeared the way it has in mainstream media, basically like no other organization. And I've always questioned why, since we seldomly hear legitimate criticism in the mainstream press, unless, of course, there's an agenda behind it. So the question is if there's an agenda to erode the last vestiges of power held by the Catholics around the world, and if this power represents some kind of stability to the out-of-control, politically correct liberalism that we now can see is actually causing a lot of problems and divisions in the world. So I know we have a lot to discuss today, but why don't we begin to just talk a little bit about the state of the Catholic Church and how it has become under so much attack in the recent years. You've written, of course, extensively about many of these issues on your website, culturewars.com, but maybe we can just go over some of this and give our audience another perspective to consider on this issue of the attacks on the Catholic Church, Michael.
Okay, yeah, I think you're right. The Catholic Church does occupy a special position. But I think in order to understand the attack, we have to go back a ways to before the United States was the world's sole superpower. Actually, even before World War II, when the United States was not yet committed to an imperial future, certainly not the one that they embarked upon after the war, to the struggle in America between the three main ethnic groups that make up America. America, there's no such thing as an American. America is like Yugoslavia. It's made up of three ethnic groups based on three religions. This is a theory, sociological theory, called the triple melting pot. I didn't make this up. The theory came into being during the 1930s, and that's precisely the time of conflict that we're talking about here. So instead of Serbs, Croats, and Muslims, which we had in Yugoslavia, we have Protestants, Catholics, and Jews in America. And these groups were involved in a constant state of struggle over which group was going to control the culture of the United States. So during the 1920s, one of the big issues was Hollywood. The Protestant majority in the country was very upset at the films that Hollywood was producing because they were full of obscenity and nudity and ridicule of clergy and God, blasphemy, the whole thing.
Yeah.
And they failed to bring the Jews who control Hollywood under control. And after that, it was the Catholics' turn. And the Catholics had a better opportunity because in 1929, Hollywood had gone into serious debt to finance the creation of talking pictures, the technology that created talking pictures. So, and then the stock market crash took place in the same year. And at this point, the Catholic Church moved against the Jews who controlled Hollywood and orchestrated a boycott of Hollywood, of Warner, actually in Philadelphia, the boycott started. It was Warner Brothers Theaters in Philadelphia that were boycotted. And Harry Warner was crying. One of the Catholics wrote back, Harry Warner's crying tears as big as horse turds because he's losing $100,000 a year in Philadelphia alone. At this point, the Jews capitulated, and they introduced what has come to be known as the production code. And so for 30 years, the Catholics pretty much had control over Hollywood films. Not complete control, but they had a kind of negative control, and they made sure that certain things were not shown. Nudity was one of them. The Catholics at this point, 31 years later, we're talking about 1965 now, we're talking about the last year of the Vatican Council. The Catholics now have become totally intimidated, totally Americanized, largely as a result of the anti-communist crusade that got launched after World War II. The Church felt that it needed the United States to defend itself against communism. It was one of those fatal political compromises that the Church makes throughout history. And so as a result, in 1965, the Catholics lost their nerve. The Jews broke the code and with a film called The Pawnbroker, which was actually a Holocaust film. And within 7 years, which is to say 1973, three of the top 10 grossing films in America were hardcore pornography. Hmm. And at this point, the Catholics, once the Catholics lost control of the culture, at least this part of the culture, it was only a moment of time before the United States could then project this power outward throughout the rest of the world. And that's what you see going on now. I think we're seeing the end game here, the end game scenario of the American empire. But that's certainly what happened from the 60s to today. The failure of the collapse, or let's put it this way, the defeat of the internal enemy allowed the Protestants and the Jews to project American power throughout the world. And basically, after the fall of communism, they became the sole superpower, and this allowed them to project this power wherever they wanted. And what was this power? It came down to basically sexual liberation as a way of softening up a population, getting them self-involved, destroying ethnic solidarity, followed by usury, IMF loans that would basically impoverish the country and put their natural resources at the disposal of international elites. And that is precisely what we saw in the Ukraine, to come up with the most recent example.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right after the coup d'etat that Victoria Nuland orchestrated January of this year, Ukraine, the coup of fascist thugs that got put in power, immediately passed sexual non-discrimination laws. And right after that, they were immediately granted IMF loans that will cripple the economy.
Really? That's an interesting little tidbit. I haven't heard that before. Huh. So you tie a lot of this back to the film industry, of course, media, entertainment, the control of the culture itself. I mean, I've heard other people talk about this as well, how the Cold War was won to a certain extent in the West, but we lost the cultural war. Why is the discussion on culture such an important issue? I mean, playing as the revolutionary, the rebel, there's this appeal to younger people. There's a lot of psychological processes and social engineering behind this, of course, of kind of controlling this issue, but using this to your advantage to kind of steer culture in a direction where you basically end up controlling the political debate eventually. So can you tell us a little bit more about, culture wars and why it's important to, you know, dominate culture in the way that they have?
Well, because you determine what's acceptable discourse and what is not. That is the whole point of cultural domination. So the Catholic Church, to get back to the period I was mentioning, said, Well, you can't undermine the sexual mores of the country. If you do, it will be totally destructive. It'll have bad effect. But what they didn't realize, I think, was this is precisely the plan that the revolutionaries had. They were way ahead of the Catholic Church in coming up with a theory of how to take control of the culture. I'm talking specifically about the theories of Wilhelm Reich. Wrote a book in the 1930s called The Mass Psychology of Fascism, in which he talked about the deliberate sexualization of the culture, something that he learned firsthand in Vienna between the wars. He was a communist and a Freudian, and he realized most people weren't interested in the last thesis of the Fourth International or whatever. But they were interested in sex, and it became a kind of mobilizing device, and he began to realize that this would be the way to undermine the Catholic Church's influence in Austria. And Reich's theories were then taken to the United States with all of these German emigres of the Frankfurt School, most notably Herbert Marcuse, whose book One Dimensional Man deals with specifically what I'm talking about. Now, Marcuse was working for the CIA, and what you see over this period of time is that they developed all of these sophisticated instruments for control, and they're still in place today. The shocking part of it is that it didn't succeed totally because it's such a diabolical, it's such a diabolical plan that you wonder how people could resist it. But the resistance did come. I think that. The turning point was 1979 in both Iran, when the Ayatollah came to power, and in Poland, when Pope John Paul II came to power. The Ayatollah referred to the United States as the Great Satan, and I think he was absolutely on target, because what we're talking about here is a regime that gains its power through the promotion of moral corruption. This is different, I think, than the Soviet Union. But what you had in 79 was twin uprisings against the two main forces of modern materialism. The Ayatollah working for the overthrow of the Shah and instituting the Islamic Republic in Iran after the fall of the Shah. And 4 months later, Pope John Paul II saying Mass in Warsaw, an officially atheistic communistic country, and creating a huge groundswell and eventually a movement that led to the collapse of communism. So that's that. First of all, that's how it worked. And then secondly, that's how it didn't work, because I think that there is an undeniable spiritual dimension to human beings that will triumph over any of these type of materialistic theories.
All very interesting. Now, you've written a book about this, of course, Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control. Maybe we can just talk a little bit more about that as well, in terms of how sexual liberation, how that was used by political control. I think a lot of the things that come from this angle has to do with a lot of, you know, naive people to a certain extent. They don't understand really the full context of how things are being used against them, you know, how political movements are being weaponized.
That's right. I think you're absolutely right. This is a form of covert warfare. The United States, after World War II, found itself in a situation where there was basically a stalemate caused by the simultaneous possession of nuclear weapons by both the America and the Soviet Union. And so as a result, they got into what has come to be known as covert warfare. And the first example of this took place right after Dwight D. Eisenhower became president. He won the election in 52. In 53, he installed the CIA basically as the operating system of the government, and their first black op was the coup against Mossadegh in Iran. And that set the playbook for basically every instance of covert operation that has taken place ever since, including, I want to emphasize, the recent incident in the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
What happened in the Ukraine is exactly the same playbook as what happened in Iran. They never changed it, unless they refined it a little bit here and there, but it was basically the same thing. And so sexual liberation as a form of control is a form of covert warfare. And the thing about covert warfare is it has to be covert. If it's not covert, it doesn't work. And I think that what I'm trying to do here is expose one of the main instruments of covert warfare, namely sexual liberation. I'm talking about birth control, which became population control. It was founded by the Rockefellers, the Population Council, and then taken over by the government as a form of control. It's not a coincidence they call it population control. This weakens the demographic thrust of any country, weakens it demographically because they know the Americans and the Rockefellers knew that political power is based on demographic power. It also corrupts the morals of the country, and that's good from these people's point of view because corrupted morals means you're weakened. Mm-hmm. You can't organize. You can't see things clearly. The best example I've given this talk in, you know, America, Europe, Asia, Africa. In 2002, the Israelis took over Ramallah in the West Bank, and they started broadcasting pornography over the local TV stations, Palestinian TV stations. And I say to the audience, why would they do that?
Yeah, that's right.
According to America, pornography is a sign of freedom.
Yeah.
This is what the People versus Larry Flint says. So I say then to the audience, I say, well, that means that the Israelis must want to bring freedom to the Palestinians, right? Well, nobody believes that. So then you have to unpack it, and you go back to St. Augustine, who says a man has as many masters as he has vices. And you understand that the systematic promotion of vice is a very effective form of control. That it was the Enlightenment that basically, it was somebody, a guy like the Marquis de Sade took St. Augustine and turned him upside down. Augustine says, if you want to be free, be moral. Whereas the Marquis de Sade saying the same thing to the controllers, if you want control, promote immorality. It's the same thing. It's the flip side of the same coin. And the Enlightenment is in many ways the flip side of Christianity. And what you have ever since the Enlightenment is more and more sophisticated instruments of control. And as I said, once you explain it, I think it loses its power because it's covert warfare. If it's not covert, if you explain it, it's not covert, and then it doesn't work anymore. And so a recent example of this is the Polish bishops. Again, there's something unique about the Polish nation because of their Christianity, because of their ethnic solidarity. But the Polish bishops just issued an attack on what they call gender ideology in January of this year. And it's based to a large extent on my book, Libido Dominandi. And so I was fortunate enough to be in Poland during the month of December. I did a book tour and got a great response because I think that once you state it this way, I think that people immediately understand what you're talking about. And once they understand it, the light goes on and they realize, here's a way out. I can understand the way this thing works. And I suddenly see that there's a possibility of dealing with it in a very simple way. You know, simply by the exercise of normal moral behavior, you can escape from the trap that the great Satan has set for everybody throughout the world.
I heard another thing in the documentary I mentioned earlier, by the way, as well. I guess something you've written about before, but the basically a reversal of, I don't know what to call it, code of conduct, perhaps the logos, the ethos, and the pathos that we've had a way, an appreciation for how to yield your will and your emotion in a certain degree, but how this now has been completely turned on its head. And now people are basically, we can see this examples every day, how people are completely run by their emotions and they lack any kind of capability appealing to their rationality. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, that's what a revolution is. It turns the world upside down. And so the classical world, we're talking about something that preceded the Christian world. The psychology I'm talking about is basically Greek. It's not really Christian. It's pagan. But basically where you had a logos, reason, using ethos or will to govern pathos or passion, symbolized by the rider on a horse. And you can find this in, for example, Euripides' play Hippolytus, which is basically about how to ride your horse. If you don't ride the horse rides you and you get trampled to death. So it's kind of like a moralized psychology. The revolution, of course, turns this upside down. And so with someone like Freud, basically what you're talking about is the systematic indulgence in passion as the sign of liberation. Reich took Freud another step farther in this regard, and that is proposed as the popular ideal. It certainly was during the 1960s, which was a revolutionary era. You know, turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream. That was a John Lennon song. I think that the controllers knew that and understood it very well, and they used it to their advantage to take control over large segments of the population. I'm interested in particular in Germany. I lived in Germany for about 3 years. I was an English teacher there during a really tumultuous period. It was the time of the Baader-Meinhof gang in Germany. And what you saw at this time was a huge sexualization of the German culture. There was a kind of wave of softcore porn films that got produced at this time in Germany with very specifically German themes. Like all the women, when they were wearing clothes, they were always wearing Dirndlkleider, you know, the traditional costume of southern Germany, Catholic Germany, as a matter of fact.
Right.
And the men would wear Lederhosen and things like that.
So it was like a taunt against their cultural heritage, really, there.
It was an attempt to ridicule, okay, the traditional German Catholic Germany. That was one aspect of it. But it was also, there was another whole group. That, they were films like, they had titles like Beim Jodeln juckt die Lederhoser. But there was another whole group of films called Schulmädchen Report, the schoolgirl reports.
Mm-hmm.
And they had about 37 of them. It just got ridiculous that they had so many of them. And I remember them. I remember the ads for them. I never went to see these films when I was teaching in Germany. But I remember the ads for them. And then I went back and looked at them, half expecting them to be like, you know, like this is catering to dirty old men who want to look at young, naked young women. But it turned out it's the opposite. What this was an attempt to sexualize the schoolgirls and encourage masturbation among schoolgirls. Now, this is right out of Wilhelm Reich's book. Now, I can't believe that this is coincidence, especially when one of the directors of one of these films turns out he was interned in England during the war and ended up working for MI5. Now, I can't believe that this is coincidence.
No.
I think that what happened is across the board, what you saw, the situation in Germany was that basically at this time they did a survey and they found that 60% of the entire German population between the ages of 20 and 30 would put a member of the Baader-Meinhof gang up in their apartment for the night if they were asked. Now, this is a huge amount of sympathy for what was a clearly violent revolutionary movement. And I think what happened is that the psychological warfare people in both the United States and Germany collaborated to come up with these porno films as a way of distracting the entire population. And I think that they were tremendously successful, because the whole thing just dried up, and now Germany is basically a bunch of sexualized, consumers. That's pretty much what it is. I mean, when you look at a place like Berlin, for example, 60% of the people in Berlin are atheists, and it has, this is off the top of my head, but probably one of the biggest populations of whores and prostitutions in all of Europe.
Really?
Huh. It's just become so ingrained in the German psyche. And the result is Germans become more and more docile the more sexualized they become.
Oh, boy. I mean, it's, when you think about it, it's brilliant then to that extent. I mean, you got to give them that. Because it's a subversive mechanism that ultimately is about control, but it is something that is designed so that people will walk into it, not only voluntarily, they will scream and grab for it because they think it's something that actually is going to set them free. Wow.
Absolutely. I think that's the genius, the evil genius. That's why it is satanic. There's no other word for it. It is satanic. And I think that the Ayatollah Khomeini was absolutely on target when he talked about America as the great Satan, because it promotes these type of policies. And I think that I was in Iran recently. I was there about 2 weeks ago, and the big issue is birth control now, because they had, after the revolution, there was a huge surge in population because the Iranians burned down their birth control clinics. And then in 1989, right after the death of the Ayatollah Khomeini, the new supreme leader allowed birth control, and they had just as dramatic a drop in population. And so now the population rate is really low. It's like 1.7 after a population rate of 3.5 after the revolution. And now they're going to go out of existence if it continues at this rate. And so, but it's all a purely consciousness, a matter of consciousness, because the majority of the Iranian people are in their childbearing years. So if they decide to have children tomorrow, the problem is over. But I said to him, I said, you know, if you don't watch out, you're going to end up like Germany. You'll end up with this aging population where you have to import workers to do your work for you. And you'll end up being this kind of docile, consumerized bunch of old people. I mean, you know, I love Germany. I love the Germans. But let's be honest about it. You know, what kind of culture do they have there? Look at Berlin. I mean, look at Düsseldorf. I was in Düsseldorf 40 years ago. I arrived in Düsseldorf. And this time, I was there a couple of years ago giving a talk. And we're going by the train station, which is where I got off. I remember that. And there's this big building. It's got numbers outside the windows. I'm thinking, what the hell is this? Well, it's a whorehouse. And you can kind of stand on the street and kind of do your window shopping and pick the number. I mean, it's unbelievable. I didn't see this 40 years ago. It's gone downhill that fast.
Yeah, it's kind of similar scenario in Amsterdam, of course, where the whole their insignia is XXX. By the way, their city insignia. That's where that comes from, that concept. But you know, I'm not a prude or anything like that against sex or anything like of that nature. But I think that the artificial suppression of it is. Led to the disassociation with kind of went from having a natural relationship to sex. But this is ultimately that actually led it to kind of slingshot in the opposite direction once the brakes was let go of. But your point here is that there is an artificially induced, you know, promiscuity and the subversion of your reason really via your emotions that is a tactic. And I think that people must understand this to be able to even break out of this. I mean, what? How do you recommend people to kind of wake up and see some of this, how it's being used against them?
Well, as I said, if you explain it to them, they understand it immediately. There's never been an audience that has not understood what I've said
right.
when I'm explaining to you what I did, beginning with the Israelis broadcasting pornography in Ramallah, and I've given this talk in Europe, in Africa, in Asia, and in America. There's never been an audience that didn't understand what I was saying. I walked into Iran two weeks ago. We flew to Shiraz, which is, you know, a couple hundred miles south of Tehran, and then we drove off into the desert about 100 miles to Fezzah, a town I had never heard of. And I walk into a room, and there are 500 people in that room. I had waited an hour because I was an hour late showing up to hear what I had to say. I mean, 500 people, total strangers. Everything has to be translated into Farsi sentence by sentence, and they understood what I was saying. They understood perfectly what I was saying.
Yeah.
So I think that what the Polish bishops understood is if you proclaim it as a kind of if you proclaim it formally, if you put it before a group of people like Polish Catholics in a serious fashion, they'll understand it, and it won't work. I mean, even given the general weakness of human nature when it comes to matters like sex, it won't work. It's not going to be the same anymore. It's not going to be the same. I think that's what we're talking about. We're talking about my understanding of history is basically a history of consciousness.
Right.
And in a sense, I got this from Hegel, who I think was a genius in understanding how God, in a sense, is in control of human history, in spite of all the intentions of all the wicked people in this world. And I think Victoria Nuland's coup d'etat in the Ukraine was a classic example of what Hegel would call the cunning of reason.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically she had her wicked intentions, her wicked neoconservative intentions about ripping the Ukraine from Russia, and she ended up restoring Crimea back to Russia, which certainly was not part of her intentions. So I think this is what we're talking about here. We're talking about a revolution in consciousness that I think began in 79, got co-opted, got stalled by the anti-communist crusade, and is now ready to happen again.
Very interesting. Now, Freudian psychoanalysis, of course, you mentioned Wilhelm Reich and the way that he kind of built further upon this, but I wanted to backtrack and try to look at the roots a little bit of this and what these some of these theories, because that's what they are, what they're built on, and how it managed to become so popular, so successful, and so incorporated into, you know, European consciousness, basically. American, too, for that matter.
Yeah. Well, I think, as I said before, you can't understand America unless you understand it as a country with three ethnic groups based on three religions. And what you saw after World War II was a covert warfare against America's Catholics. At that time, America still had a what we call here a WASP ruling class, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, symbolized by the Rockefellers, who believed in the spread of birth control and things like that. Over this period of time, the Jews were junior partners, let's say after World War II. People like the Frankfurt School were brought into the United States to staff the universities and create an atmosphere where that was brought about the dissemination of what you would have to say were revolutionary ideas. And Sigmund Freud's ideas were part of this. And so what happened over this period of time is, as Jewish influence increased in the United States, the influence of Sigmund Freud increased as well. He was just one of many Jewish thinkers, and psychology became an essentially Jewish operation. And eventually what you saw was, with the decline of the WASP ruling class, the Jews simply filled the vacuum. So they got into Harvard. Harvard became an essentially Jewish institution because they knew how to take the SAT scores. They knew how to cheat on the SAT scores. And by the mid-70s, what you had here was the passing of the old guard. 1978, John D. Rockefeller and Nelson Rockefeller died. And 1976, Woody Allen is on the cover of Time magazine being portrayed as an American genius. Not a Jewish genius, but an American genius. And so what you saw here was basically the Jewish takeover of American culture that the Catholics had stalled. They had postponed this for 31 years because of their control of Hollywood through the production code. But once the brakes were taken off, it happened very quickly. And that's the culture that we have today. It's basically Jewish culture. And no one is allowed to object. If you criticize a Jew, you're called an anti-Semite and they try to destroy you.
Sure, yeah.
But across the world, this is not something unique to the United States, but that is simply the situation in the United States right now. And the bitter fruits of all this were basically the neoconservative takeover of American foreign policy under the George Bush administration, which led to the invasion of Iraq in 2003, which now, as we before our very eyes, is unraveling, a total collapse of that whole regime that was shows the disastrous effect that the neoconservatives had on American foreign policy.
Yeah.
We still don't see the end of that right now.
And I mean, look at as well. We have the photos up on the website right now. How John McCain, one of the other neocons, that shows up and taking over some of the roles of like people like Rumsfeld and Cheney. We had that, of course, that meeting with Rumsfeld back in I think it was 87 or maybe even earlier with Saddam Hussein, of course,
sure.
Meeting good buddies. Now he was down meeting up with the ISIS guard down there not too long ago. The U.S. government, of course, supplied them with weapons, with funding and everything else, and now it's getting out of hand. I think what people are missing there is that all these groups, all this opposition is controlled, is set up by the powers that be, by the neocons, by, of course, their AIPAC. You know, you have the whole thing going on there. And the fact is that these groups are not, it's not accidental that this is occurring. I think it's by design that this is spiraling out of control now. It's going to be.
No, I would disagree with you.
Really?
There. I don't think it's spiraling out of control by design. I think we're talking about blowback here. I think we're talking about what I just said about Hegel and the cunning of reason. These people had clear intentions. It's clear that the Israel lobby controls the American Congress.
Sure.
There's absolutely no question. If you want proof, go back to that picture of Benjamin Netanyahu addressing the Congress in, I believe, May of 2012, 26 standing ovations. They're the Congress of the most powerful nation on earth, jumping up and down like puppets every time Netanyahu says something banal.
Right.
And why is that? Because of AIPAC money. It was in the New York Times afterwards. This is not secret information. AIPAC informed those people, if you don't jump up and give a standing ovation, we cut off your money. Now, this is this is catastrophic. This has been catastrophic. And so America doesn't have a foreign policy. It basically has is a proxy for Israel's foreign policy.
Right. Yeah.
And one of the main lackeys of the Israel lobby is John McCain. The other one is Lindsey Graham. They're all over the place.
Yeah.
You know? And so what did they want? Well, they wanted to overthrow the Assad regime, okay? Because the main villain from the Israelis' point of view, from, let's say, Benjamin Netanyahu's point of view, is Iran. And the main problem that Israel had was this basically Shia crescent that went from Iran, Iraq, Syria, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and then down to the support of the Palestinians. They wanted to break this, so the weakest link they felt was Assad. So they started arming these Sunni, the insurgents, giving them weapons.
Mm.
Well, guess what? All these weapons are now being used in Iraq. There's basically no border between Syria and Iraq. You give the people the weapons, give these people the weapons in Syria, they can take them across the border, and that's precisely what happened. And so the irony here now is that the United States State Department, specifically John Kerry and Obama, are trying desperately to come to an agreement with the Iranians now to try and save what's left of the Iraqi government and protect the Americans in the green zone. You know? It's just, so my point here is, this was not intentional, I'm sure. I guarantee you that same thing happened in Ukraine. It was not, Victoria Nuland did not start this coup d'etat with the intention of having Crimea go back to Russia.
Well,
I guarantee
of course,
you that.
No, of course. Yeah, you're right.
And I think that what we're seeing here is in terms of the intelligence community is called blowback. It's called blowback, and that has been a function, a feature of the United States foreign policy in the Middle East ever since, probably ever since Mossadegh, but I mean certainly ever since Afghanistan when they armed the Mujahideen in Afghanistan.
So with the creation of Al-Qaeda fighting Russia way back when, and then allegedly, of course, we have 9/11 occurring, they kind of saying, oh, it all kind of got out of hand. Is there, in your view, a similar scenario here with ISIS and everything else, that there's actually a real threat of terrorism, let's say, against America or other European countries now because of what they have been doing down there?
Well, I think the major threat is to Israel, to be perfectly honest with you.
Right.
I think this was the whole point of Curry's reluctance to give these people serious weapons. You know, I mean, Bandar bin Sultan sort of waged this war on the cheap, the Saudi former defense minister, by giving these people, you know, going into the refugee camps and giving them an AK-47 and a pack of cigarettes and $100 a month. But when Curry came in, the first thing he said was no heavy weapons. And then Assad started to win, and then they're in a bind. Well, what do you do? Well, I think the main reason he was reluctant was because he knows that these people are going to march on Israel. They already had a skirmish in the Golan Heights. There were symbolic gestures where the Takfiri or the rebels would fire their AK-47s into Israel from the Golan. I think the main threat is going to be to Israel. That's the main instance of blowback that we're going to see from this thing, I think. And we may reach a point where Israel will start begging Iran to protect them. That would be a real irony, but I don't think it's totally beyond the realm of possibility.
Well, they will definitely have America do their dirty work first, right? I mean, what do you think the response from Israel and, of course, America, run by AIPAC and everything else, the foreign policy, what would the response be to something like that if Israel was attacked in some way?
Well, they are on record as saying we'd have to support them, you know, but I mean, the support has already eroded. I mean, first of all, the fact that America, under the Obama administration, did not attack Iran is significant. And then the fact in 2013, August, when that false flag poison gas attack took place in Syria. And again, the United States didn't attack Syria, didn't attack Iran. Now, this has been a huge disappointment to Netanyahu and his cronies over there. And I think that what you're seeing here is a progressive attempt on the part of the Obama administration to cut a deal with Iran, because they know they need them for stability in the region. So right after the IPAC is furious that Iran, the United States tried to create a entered into nuclear negotiations with Iran, and the result was the sanctions bill that got defeated in January, the first significant defeat for IPAC in IPAC's history, largely because there's another Jewish lobby, J Street, that gave them a way out, and J Street supports Obama. So what you see here is a desperate attempt on the part of the Obama administration to work out a deal with Iran. And I think this is itself a huge defeat for Israel. So things are not going the way the Israel, the Likudniks certainly want them to go in Israel. Now, how that final scenario is going to work out is anyone's guess.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of variables here. And there seems to be so many, you know, games and internal conflicts and everything else going on at the same time that it seems to be, I mean, sometimes at least I have a view that it's kind of very much run by a central, you know, point in some way, very much in that regard, conspiratorially run. But then you realize the more you bring in different variables into it that, maybe they don't have that much control as they wish that they had. There are things going on in this world which is outside of their control, and they're trying to constantly kind of adjust to those new variables, and consequently it kind of more and more gets out of control almost, right?
I think you're absolutely right. I think that there is one mind which controls history, and that's God's mind. And there are a lot of people who want to play God and think they're so powerful that they can be God, but their intentions have no hegemony over reality. And so what you have here is the intentions of evil men bringing about God's plan. That's what Hegel called the cunning of reason. It's in the Bible. I mean, when Joseph is sold into slavery by his brothers, he ends up in Egypt. He ends up in a very high position in Egypt, and the brothers have to come to him because there's famine in Israel. And when they finally recognize Joseph, he says to them, "The evil that you intended to do to me has been turned by God's power into good." And I think that's the plan for human history. There's no question that there are plenty of people with all sorts of wicked intentions, but the history is created by God. I mean, time and space, these things are created by God, and if they're created by God, they have to have a good outcome. And that's what I'm saying here. That I think that if you have the eyes to see it, you can see the unraveling of all of these evil designs. Now, I'm the first guy. Everybody over here calls me a conspiracy nut because I do research. That's why.
Right,
because
exactly.
I found out things that they don't know about, and they get mad at me because I know things they don't know, and they call me a conspiracy nut.
Yeah.
But I'm saying, even given that, even given these conspiracies, that their intentions don't have hegemony over reality. Only
right.
God's intentions do.
Yeah, there are certainly things happening in this world which you know, we seem to lose control over it, and things go in a certain direction no matter how many people push you know, for one thing, and then the outcome is another. So I believe there's something to that. Now there's many more aspects here I want to discuss and get into in more detail. Maybe we can begin something here that we potentially might have to continue in the next segment here. We're coming up on a break in a few minutes here, but the rise of political correctness, let's just kind of tackle this a little bit here towards the end of the first segment, and how you see that this is being used today to, for example, you know, squash research even like your own to a certain degree. Of course, you guys in America still have the First Amendment, but it's kind of the erosion of it has occurred from a different angle this time. And I mean, in Europe, for example, you, of course, can be jailed for questioning certain things historically or talking about certain things, but how do you see political correctness being used as a way to completely control and even shut down the type of research that you're doing?
Well, political correctness, I think, first of all, to be optimistic about it, is a sign that the conventional narrative is failing. Because there was a time when you didn't have to enforce these codes of thought. The people believed in them. They believed in them. They believed that America stood for certain things. And then over the period of time, it's become apparent that America, for example, does not stand for democracy. America really does not believe in democracy. A recent instance of this is the gay marriage debate. 12 states in the United States had referenda banning gay marriage. all 12 of the, that means the majority of the people of those states, 12 states in the United States, were against gay marriage and was instituted as part of the law of that state by referendum, by democratic process. All of those referenda were overturned by federal judges. So it's obvious that the United States does not believe in democracy. It just uses this as part of its rhetoric to push forward its agenda.
Yeah.
So political correctness arrived on the scene when the conventional forms of social control fell apart. And so what you're seeing here, there's also a Jewish angle to this. Political correctness is Jewish. I mean, I was there. I had a front row seat. I think if you saw that documentary, you saw me talking about the takeover of literary criticism.
Oh yeah, that's right.
In the university during the 1970s. I had a front row seat. Stanley Fish was my teacher. Stanley Fish is one of the main defenders of political correctness. He's a literary critic. Well, what you're seeing here is this Jewish form of thought control. The Jews are notorious for being commissars. They were commissars in the Soviet Union. They ran groups, secret police groups like the Cheka. They would torture Russians because Russians didn't like to torture each other. What you're seeing here is the rise of political correctness is another word for the Jewish takeover of the university. It got implemented first at the university. I was at the university. I was a professor back in the late 70s or early 1980s. I realized that I didn't have the academic freedom to be against abortion at a Catholic university. I got fired. And so what you have there is a selection process where basically anyone who had some type of independence of thought was forced out of the university, and the control became more and more draconian, more and more Jewish, more and more Talmudic, to the point where it has become basically intolerable to anybody has any type of free human spirit.
Well, let's pick this up conversation here after the break, E. Michael Jones. It's very interesting, a lot to talk about here, of course. Let's talk a little bit more about your website, though, culturewars.com. There's a couple of titles there, of course, we have been talking about that I want you to mention a little bit more about. Libido Dominandi, of course, that we talked about first, and then, of course, the Jewish revolutionary spirit. But you have much more on there. Tell us a little bit about the website.
Well, it's basically, you know, the 33 years of research into what happened here. Independent research, because you can't do this research at the university anymore. So it's kind of like university-level research geared toward a popular audience over all of the themes that I think were the most important, the sexualization of the culture, the rise of an explanation of basically the Jews that makes sense from a non-racial, from a religious point of view. The explanation of what happened to our cities, that's the slaughter of cities, urban renewal is ethnic cleansing. One thing after another. It's kind of, I guess it's got my intellectual autobiography, you know, just a guy who got thrown into a situation trying to figure out why he got fired for being against abortion at a Catholic college and spending years and years and years of research trying to pick this whole thing apart.
Yeah.
And coming up with a critique that, you know, I think will stand the test of time. At least I hope it will.
Yeah, I think it will. There's a lot of interesting things there, and I have by no means gone through all of it. There's just tons and tons on the website, and of course a lot of books I urge people to check out there. I think there'll be something there that will spark your interest, as it were. But culturewars.com, head on over there, check it out. We'll of course pick this up right after the break. Stay with us, Michael. We'll be right back.
Den höga Fürstammar, der hab ich mich wohl in Kammer, dessen just faller fort, und rieber er sonst nörst, dessen just faller fort, und rieber er sonst an jüsen rödast flamma. Ja, trides Gott, i laga källen, Oh, dude.